We're going to call the Senate Education Committee to order on this 4th of May.
Thank you.
Oh my God.
Perfect.
I'm called away to speak with Senator Palpatine, but I'll wait here.
Okay.
So with that, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2314. So we'll hear a short explanation.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2314 allows the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to set minimum standards by rule for graduation from hair design, barbering, aesthetics, or nail technology schools.
Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, move to the floor, I do, with a pass recommendation, House Bill 2314.
Beautiful.
Senator Lithicum moves that House Bill 2314 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? No discussion. Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so moved. Is there anyone that would love to carry the barbering one? I don't feel like I have the hair to do that, but I will if no one else wants to. Okay. You want? Okay. Thank you very much.
You do have good hair.
You don't have the hair to
yeah,
carry
that's
it?
True.
I'm still back on the motion. With the yoga. This is too much for me. I can't take it. I'm not this fun.
With that, we'll close our work session on 2314, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2648. So I'll have a short explanation, and please come to the floor, our illustrious guest from the House.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2648 adds school social workers to the list of professions included in school-based systems for which school districts or education service districts may receive monies for decreasing rates of absenteeism. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, thank you, Senator Roblin, Vice Chair Lithicum, and members of the committee. I'm Margaret Doherty, and I'm the state rep for House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. House Bill 2648 makes a very minor fix and addition to a current state program that aims to lower absenteeism in school districts. Currently, a school district is eligible to apply for grant funds through the Chief Education Office and the Oregon Health Authority if a school district has a school-based health center, which provides behavioral health services and uses a trauma-informed approach to serve students and address absenteeism. There are a variety of professionals outlined in the current statute that the school district can employ. And it's a school nurse, a school counselor, a school psychologist, a clinical psychologist. But what House Bill 2648 does is simply adds school social workers, and I emphasize school social workers because that's a different licensure, to the list of approved behavioral health professionals that a district can use. To provide the trauma-informed approach addressing absenteeism in our schools. So the minor fix will provide school districts with an additional option to choose from while trying to serve their students, and I urge an aye vote, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? I guess the only thing that for me is more of a statement. You know, we haven't had a lot of social workers in our schools,
no.
And yet when you consider that we really are a community and mm-hmm. we are really trying to work with parents, families, and the whole to help these kids, that they have a training that's really
It is very important because, as I say, this was just a grant program. I think we got $500,000. We were asking for $5 million last time. And but back in the old days, we had a child development specialist in every single elementary and middle school in the state of Oregon. And there were trained social workers and trained, you know, people to go through and work with the issues that teachers either are not trained to do or administrators, they don't have the time to do it. And a lot of that deals with the social issues, whether it's homelessness, whether it's abuse. And, and with absenteeism, the one example I use is one of my elementary schools in my region. I was there for a visit, a great principal, and one of the little kids, a second grader, would just bolt out of class. And so he was not getting the education. He would just bolt. And she tried everything from a Halloween costume to everything to try to bribe him to go back. And it could have been one of the reasons he did keep bolting is the year before he had been pulled out of the home because of domestic abuse. And while he was on the phone talking to his mother, his comment was, "Well, I hope Daddy didn't leave bruises on you like the last time." And so these are the sort of traumas that the children are facing that they need the professional help to get over that hump so they stay in school. And that's what the bill's purpose is.
Thank you. I don't see anybody else.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else on our list? No one else on our list. We look forward to putting this bill up for a work session.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. We'll close our public hearing on 2648, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2997. We'll have a short explanation. And Representative Smith, come on up.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2997 requires that half of collected truancy fines are sent to school districts or education service districts, and the other half sent to the state, county, or municipal government, depending on which court entered the judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Greg Smith, and I represent District 57. Mr. Chair, thank you very much for having me here. I just want to briefly testify on House Bill 2997. You never know where legislation's going to come from. One evening, I'm putting on my tap dance shoes in an event called Dancing with the Stars in Hermiston, when a lady by the name of Dolores, who works for the Hermiston School District, came up to me and she said, "You know, it just doesn't seem fair that I'm working on truancy issues and trying to get kids in school and trying to get them back. And sometimes we have to go to the courts and sometimes a fine is assessed. And even though the school did all the work, the money goes to the court system." And I started visiting with her on that, and I said, "Gosh, what do you think if we introduced a piece of legislation where when dollars are generated as a result of a truancy violation, that half of it comes back to the school?" And Dolores thought that made a lot of sense. And so, Mr. Chair, what we've done is we've drafted House Bill 2997 for your consideration. What this bill does is it allows half of collected fines from truancy violations to be sent to the school. And these fines are nominal. They're only $80. Some would say, "Well, why are you even wasting your time?" Well, the reality is $40 in our schools can go a long way. It might be able to help buy a magazine subscription. It might be able to help a student go on a field trip that otherwise may not be able to go. And in my view, and I hope in yours, you view it as the right thing to do. These truancy officers are doing everything they can to get the kids in school, to keep the kids in school, and I'd like to do all we can to support them. And I hope we can get your support. And I would like to thank Representative Doherty and the OSCA for helping shepherd this bill along.
So, any questions? Yes.
Yeah, just curiosity, how often does this happen where it goes to court and there's a fine assessed?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I don't think it's an issue that occurs very often.
Right.
To me, it's almost the principle as much as it is the dollar amount, and it's the fair and right thing to do.
So, and I'll just add a little bit to that. We had a truancy officer in Coos County for a long time, and we took a number of parents to school. Most of the judges imposed a requirement that they attend school with the student for the next number of days, as opposed to the fine.
Right,
they could do both, and if people reoffended, it could do that. I think that the idea of some of it coming back to school, you could use that as part of an incentive program with that family, that if he's in school, maybe he can get some of it back. I think there's a lot of things that could be done. I don't think he'll ever get a lot of money, though, but
no,
I agree with that.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't objecting. Just a curiosity.
Yeah,
is all.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. Yes, Senator Lithicum.
With regard to the curiosity that Senator Cruz raised in terms of disadvantaged families and whatever, do we know how impactful this is? Truancy convictions, quote unquote, sounds like it carries a lot of weight. It's not big, it's not large. By our standards, but by others in different communities, it very well could be large.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Lithicum, I would not disagree with you. I'm not an educator. I don't know the hard facts behind the question you've raised. Again, I just brought this issue forward because I thought it was the right thing to do.
I think that there are very few school districts that it would be the first time that they were had a problem with attendance that they would end up in court. Most of the schools work really hard at doing that before they ever get to that point. So I agree. Any other questions? Thank you.
Appreciate you, Mr.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this bill? We don't have anybody. With that, we're going to close our public hearing on 2997, and we will set up a work session for that in the near future. With that, we're going to open on a public hearing on House Bill 3106, preschool programs, and we'll have a short explanation. And is Representative Wilson here?
Justin Rainey, I think.
Oh, Justin, are you going to talk about this one? Okay, you can come on up if you want. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 3106 requires early learning hubs to convene annual meetings between representatives of the Oregon pre-kindergarten program and preschool program to coordinate the enrollment of eligible children and the provision of programs that best meet the needs of eligible children and their families. The bill requires early learning council to adopt rules to implement plans for changes to the federal Head Start program. It allows the ELC to adopt rules to provide half-day, full-day, or combined preschool programs based on community assessments.
Okay. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Justin Rainey, I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Head Start Association. We're here today in support of House Bill 3106. What this bill does is it does two simple things. The first is it encourages collaboration of the different early learning providers at the local hub level during the enrollment process as we work to find children and communities and help assess what the best program is for them. The second portion of the bill is something that was brought to us by the Early Learning Division that would essentially allow them to adopt some rules to give them flexibility as we move to full-day program for Head Start programs. So the Head Start Association brought this bill forward to address some of the problems that we had with enrollment this last year with some of the early learning providers and programs, and basically just to try and get stronger coordination and better coordination. We believe that's a good, simple fix. In 2015, the legislature passed House Bill 3380, which created the Preschool Promise Program. This is a measure that we supported, and it's a program that we're continuing to support. We've worked to expand access to early learning for all kinds of children, and this focuses on the mixed delivery system. So it was always envisioned that the programs would work closely together, so this bill simply directs that they do that. The second, this one thing I do want to put on the record because it came up in the House, this bill, the Head Start Association, we do a lot of work, and our strength is parental involvement. So we think it's important that parents do have the choice to choose what program that they go to. Nothing in this bill is intended to change parental choice. So through our discussions, we feel a child would be better served in a different program, but they don't want to go to that program, they can choose the program that they want to be a part of. In terms of the second portion of the bill, I'll just speak briefly to that. As I said earlier, it provides flexibility for the Early Learning Division to adopt rules so they can help local Head Start programs comply with some of the federal changes that were adopted November 7th of 2016. Currently, Head Start programs provide services for 3.5 hours per day up to 128 days a year. Federal changes approved in 2016 proposed new minimums of 6 hours per day and 1,096 hours over the course of that year. The programs have roughly 5 years to phase in and adopt to these changes. So in order to meet the federal changes, we want the Early Learning Division to have flexibility with how they do that, how they integrate some of the state-funded OPK dollars, because there may be some communities where it makes sense to offer half-day programs or to at least have that option or not jump right to the six. So this just simply gives them flexibility to start conversations around meeting the federal requirements. Okay. With that, I'd encourage you to support House Bill 3106.
Any questions, sir, Justin? Yes, Senator Lith.
Your comment about the 6 hour, you use the phrase minimum. Is that at the federal level, a 6 hour minimum?
The federal changes that went in November 7th of 2016 changed to the 6 hours, yes.
Well,
I know, it's a big change. Did they send a lot of money?
With a five-year roll-in.
I know.
Right, yeah, I heard the five-year roll-in, but I was still surprised.
Are they planning on increasing the amount of money by double as well?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, your guess is as good as mine on that. But I would be very skeptical that we get additional funding to implement the changes.
So, any other questions? Thank you very much, Justin. Dana Hepper.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the Director of Policy and Program at the Children's Institute. And we are also here in support of House Bill 3106A. We, alongside the Oregon Head Start Association, worked really closely on House Bill 3380 in 2015, which then became the Preschool Promise Program. And we now have a mix of providers well-suited to meet families' needs operating in many communities in the state, preschool programs funded by the state. So we have school districts, Head Start providers, in-home and center-based child care providers, all offering a high-quality preschool program for low-income 3- and 4-year-olds in Oregon. We're currently serving between our federal and state investments in Head Start and our investment in the Preschool Promise Program, about 15,000 low-income 3- and 4-year-olds across the state are enrolled in a publicly funded, high-quality preschool program, and about 25,000 low-income 3- and 4-year-olds are not enrolled in a high-quality, publicly funded preschool program. So we still have a lot of headway to go. It was always the intention that hubs would play the role of coordinating among local providers to ensure that we were filling every single slot, because we have more than enough kids to do so. And this just codifies that commitment. So we're excited to see it moving forward.
Any questions for Dana? Okay, thank you very much. Is there anyone else sitting out in the audience that is dying to get up on the stand and testify? Do not see anyone. So we are going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3106. We'll also move that one to a work session in the near future. With that, we have an informational meeting about the new science campus at the University of Oregon. So we will open an informational hearing on that. And I was privy to a conversation a little while ago about this, and excited to hear about it.
Is there a Star Wars exhibit there?
There will be, I'm sure. I've heard some Star Wars-ish kinds of things that they do and are planning to do there, so we'll hear some more.
Only on the surface of the light side, I have to say. Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, thank you so much for hearing us today. My name is Patrick Phillips. You may hear I have a little frog in my throat from the general environment of Oregon as we go into the spring here. I'm the acting executive director of the new science campus at the University of Oregon. I'm also a biology professor. We want to talk to you today about what we think is really a revolutionary new opportunity for the University of Oregon, for Lane County, the state, and not only the University of Oregon, but all the universities and higher education institutions in the state. It's really a unique event that we are trying to push forward here, and it's really a once-in-a-generation opportunity, I think, given the scale of what we're talking about. Michelle, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes. Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Lithicum, my name is Michelle Sconce, and I'm a doctoral candidate or graduate student at the University of Oregon, and I'll be talking about some of my research later on in the presentation.
So we have a little presentation here that you're welcome to follow along on, and of course we'd be happy to provide any additional materials to you at a later date that you would like. So what is it? What are we doing? Well, in October of last year, we announced a new $1 billion initiative at the University of Oregon to launch a new science campus. It's kicked off by a $500 million gift, and what we're interested in talking about with you today is the partnership that the state and the University of Oregon can make together. So the The initiative that we have here, we talk a lot about research, and the University of Oregon has historically been extremely strong in their research efforts, but we're coupling now research and development. And on the development side, we're really talking about how can we take the many scientific discoveries that we make at the University of Oregon and then push them out into society to have a broader impact. And so that can mean a lot of different things, but among them, of course, are spinning out businesses and other opportunities that will have a direct economic impact on the state and help build our infrastructure there. So before I actually talk too much about the science, I want to talk a little bit about the logistics of what we're talking about. So this is a 10-year plan. $1 billion, the initial phase is to build two 75,000 square foot buildings on the north side of Franklin Boulevard, if you've been to Eugene, and to equip them with state-of-the-art equipment to facilitate new research. This new space then will allow us to recruit, again, over a 10-year period, 30 new research faculty, which will result, because of the multipliers that exist, in about 700 new students and researchers working in these new facilities. So it's a major expansion of our research capacity at the University of Oregon. Importantly, and I can dwell on this later, this is something that we're adding to the campus without creating additional financial load on the rest of the university, so there's no additional tuition load or general funds load in what we're trying to accomplish here. So this is a great expansion for the students of the University of Oregon without an additional financial commitment. And the University of Oregon has a nice history of spinning out businesses in this context. For instance, EGI and NEMA Metrics are companies that the university has produced recently, and the idea is to really accelerate that process tremendously. So the fundamental mission of the new science campus is science advancing society, and we plan to do that by dramatically shortening the timeline between discovery and societal impact, and that's through a real focus on research, on training, and especially entrepreneurship, which is really bringing all those programs together in one place and having a very outward-looking face to the university is something that's brand new for us, I think. And it's very responsive both to the state needs as well as what students are looking for these days. So there are many benefits of what we're trying to accomplish. First of all, there's some just completely game-changing state benefits in terms of creating a new regional hub for the South Willamette Valley for innovation and entrepreneurship. It also will enhance the academic and national reputation, both of the University of Oregon and all the institutions within the state, and of course the state as a whole. And most importantly, it'll fuel this economic transformation. I think we all recognize that we're in a new economy, and there's sort of a startup ethos among many of our students and faculty, and so we really want to be supporting that kind of effort. And importantly, again, this will be in partnership with other institutions within the state. And so we can think of that in terms of the statewide impact, because it really sets the University of Oregon up to help leverage and support the strengths of our other state institutions, such as OSU, PSU, and OHSU, and as well as our signature research centers that we've already been participating in. And what Michelle will talk about, a little bit about is a great strength of this effort is to really keep Oregon talent in Oregon. Right now, if someone makes a discovery, tries to start a new company, it's actually difficult in Oregon to get that process started, and they're very likely just to head right to Seattle or the Bay Area. We're sort of stuck between these two attractive poles, and we'd really like to create a new way of supporting and retaining that talent here. And of course, with these new core facilities and research facilities, we'll have connections with the other campuses to make sure that we're enhancing their research opportunities as well. And we've already started extensive conversations with OHSU on that. So just a couple of weeks ago, we helped host a new collaborative research summit with OHSU. 80 faculty from both institutions came. We actually met at Western Oregon University in one of their beautiful new buildings and got together to think about what the future is in terms of strengthening our relationships. And we already have many deep collaborations with OHSU faculty as well as OSU and PSU faculty. So we think that this is really helping to spur a new set of conversations about both the relationships between the universities, but also how we can rethink the public-private relationship between the universities and the state and businesses as we move forward. And I think it's a very exciting time for that. So again, the focus here is really creating this clear line of sight between discovery and impact, and to try and condense that. And that's often a very perilous path that that both faculty and students have to tread. And once we build this infrastructure, we're also hoping that it'll become an attraction point, not only for just the efforts that we're doing at the University of Oregon, but actually outside companies will be attracted to the area so that they can use the science facilities that we're producing and also the entrepreneurial talent that we'll be developing at that time. So what are the particulars here? So during the initial construction phase, we'll be generating $176 million in initial total economic output, and that will generate 1,300 new jobs. And importantly, that generates $11 million in new tax revenue just from the first few years during construction. So this is really an effort that pays for itself, depending on how you like to count those things. But a very important element of this, I think it's critical, is that all the activities that we build in these buildings, I know it's quite a challenge for capital construction. We build a nice building. How do you actually then pay for the ongoing, both maintenance of that building and the operations in that? That will all be supported through the funds that we're already will be investing in this. And so it's a sustained, perpetual economic impact, both through the direct investment from the university as well as new grant activity that will be generated of $79 million a year, 750 jobs a year, which generates $7 million of state and local tax revenue. And this is just, we work with Eco Northwest to generate these numbers. They would only allow us to count the numbers that we could directly attribute to the dollars that we were spending. They were we were not allowed to include any new business activity that's generated through this effort. So we really think that this is the absolute floor in terms of the economic impact that we'll be generating through this effort. So we're here today to just let you know what's going on, and it's part of an overall partnership that we're really seeking with the state to be able to maximize this impact. So we're looking for the state to invest $100 million in G-bonds, and the university will then match that with $100 million of direct investment, and then we'll be bringing the remainder of our gift funds in this first phase to actually pay for the programs in that. And so as we look towards what we're actually going to accomplish, the faculty who came up with this idea really focused on this this concept of the impact cycle. So right now, if you start at one side where inquiry is, and this is something that universities have historically been really good on, we can do research, and that can lead to insights. But this bottom arrow is very difficult to get the innovations out to impact. But importantly, we're not looking at just having things spin out from the university. We really want the new insights that we gather through building those things and actually building new technologies that allow us to ask new scientific questions, for those to spin back in and then to keep that cycle going. And again, one of the emphases is to keep Oregonians in Oregon so that we can keep this cycle spinning and keep the research flowing, keep the economic activity going. So we thought that the best way to illustrate this would be to show you one little story. We have a video about the research of one of our faculty members, Karen Gilliman, and some recent discoveries that her lab has made. And then Michelle, who's one of Dr. Gilliman's graduate students, can talk to you a little bit about the work that she's doing as well. So I think I just have to click on it.
I think the way I remember it is that Karen and I literally sat down for coffee to talk about what I wanted to do my thesis on.
Well, it was a series of conversations.
I sort of had this idea kind of sitting in the back of my head, and so we just asked a very basic question
about developmental biology,
whether or not bacteria may or may not influence the development of the pancreas and pancreatic beta cells.
The answer could have been yes or it could have been no, and the answer was yes, that there was an impact on development. And then that immediately provoked the next question.
Can we influence the development of those pancreatic
insulin-producing
beta cells? So, and we found that we could.
You know, we just kept on following this lead when we learned that there were specific bacteria that could do this. And then Jennifer asked, well, are they secreting anything that could do this?
And so to kind of get at that question, we used the very simple tools that we have available in the lab, which is the zebrafish model organism.
Then she started, you know, just drilling down and asking, well, what is this material?
Identity of this product.
And so that gave us a clue that this is likely to be a secreted protein involved.
And so then we had a list of possible candidates.
It was about 165 proteins.
The genome, 163. We narrowed that huge list down to one possible candidate.
You know, when she told me this, I was entirely skeptical. I was like, there's no way that this could, you know, have worked out this well.
We named it beta cell expansion factor A, or BEF-A.
Hey, Beth. You know, it was just a remarkable day when she put that on sterile germ-free fish, and all of a sudden, beta cells just exploded. It was so crystal clear from that image that this was a big deal.
Not because we're curing diabetes or anything like that.
But this protein has the potential for being developed into a therapeutic for type 1 diabetes.
You know, if this can help people, we want it to help people.
Realizing its therapeutic potential.
For the first time, we're showing that a protein produced by a bacteria is actually capable of acting on this very important and essential cell population of the pancreas, the beta cells.
Great, thank you. So Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Lithicum. So I am a graduate student in the Gilliman Lab, and I'm actually fortunate enough to be working on this project. And something that we're really interested in trying to understand in our research is how the gut microbiota within all of us and within animals, how that affects our host cells. And specifically, I'm interested in development and development of the pancreas. So essentially, what Jennifer found is that if you compare these zebrafish that have their microbes, their bacteria, and you compare them to fish that don't, those beta cells don't expand when the microbiota, the bacteria, isn't present. And so what Jennifer found is this protein, this BEF-A protein, that if you add it directly to these germ-free fish, it rescues beta cell expansion, which is pretty amazing, because it's just one protein that is secreted from our own microbiota, from our own bacteria. So where my research comes in is trying to understand, how does this happen? How does this one secreted protein affect beta cells to proliferate? And as you may or may not know, beta cells are really important for us because they secrete insulin. So people with, say, type 1 diabetes, where these cells are dying off, this could be a very novel thing if we can understand how it works. So for me, where the U of O science complex actually comes in is that it's going to greatly accelerate my work and really lead how innovative this could be, and I'll be getting the best training in Oregon, as well as learning new techniques that I wouldn't otherwise get the opportunity to do. And also, I think aside from my own research and really helping it grow and getting that great training, what's also a really wonderful opportunity with the new U of O science complex is I think it's going to be a wonderful opportunity for women in science. I serve on the UOWGS, or Women of Graduate Sciences, as an officer, and Our main goal is gender equality in the sciences, and we are making it our priority to ensure that the new faculty who get hired for the U of O Science Complex are diverse and that women are present and to bring in a diverse group of faculty. And other than that, we do a lot of work in the local communities and trying to get girls in local elementary schools interested in science, and we do a lot of community outreach. And I see that the science complex only helping to build our own program as well. And then aside that, as a native Oregonian, I'd like to speak about the U of O Science Complex. I'm a fourth generation Oregonian, and I'm very proud of that because I love Oregon as a state, and I love living here. My grandfather was actually a logger in Oregon for 38 years, and my father actually has worked in a mill for most of my life and actually would work with the logs that came from my grandfather's company. And also, I have two older sisters. We all went to universities in Oregon, and my oldest sister is actually a first grade teacher, and she did her practicum with the same kindergarten teacher we all had, and ended up taking her job when that kindergarten teacher had retired. So I think I look at the U of O Science Complex not only as a wonderful opportunity for my research, for bringing women into science, but also as an opportunity for me to give back to the community and put U of O, the Oregon, on the forefront of science and innovation. And also, I've also worked at the VA hospital in Portland in Parkinson's disease, and obviously I did my undergrad at Pacific University. And by the time I get my PhD, I will have been training in science in Oregon for well over 11 years. And I would like to keep that training in Oregon. You know, I could go to California, I could go to Washington or the East Coast, but this is my home, and this is where I want to stay, this is where I was trained, and I want to help build Oregon as a whole. And I think this is a wonderful opportunity to do that, and for me to take my training and really build my home here through science and innovation. Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. So I think Michelle really highlighted the impacts. We talk a lot about the scientific impact, but we're very conscious of the community impact. We've engaged with the city, lots of conversations with them. We see our place in the county. We see a role in providing a future for Oregonians. And I think that that's really part of everything that we're looking at when we look at this effort. It's really important to us. It's a very outward engaged endeavor. So just to wrap up then, I do think that this is really an unprecedented opportunity for the state. It's very important that as we build these buildings, that we build them at the scale that's necessary. You only have one chance to build these buildings. It's a 100-year effort, essentially. We have to build them at the scale that's appropriate to support the rest of the enterprise that we're trying to do. We can't come back and redo that later. And so that's why we're really asking for this partnership now. It's a one-time chance here. And these will have impacts on the community, both the economic impacts as well as we'll be directly participating in research that will affect the health and well-being of Oregonians as well as other people in the country. And then finally, many people have recognized the importance of this. So this is a rapidly growing list of little logos of people and organizations that are very supportive of the efforts that we're doing. We have the support of the other universities. We have the supports of labor unions, of research societies, the industry groups, all sorts of things. And so it's really a wide effort that that we're trying to build here. And so with that, I'll close, and I, both of us actually would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Lithgow.
I don't have, well, I may have questions, but the video you show is quite fascinating and insightful, kind of leap. I'm curious a little bit about insight to innovation. And if you're thinking in the line of technological patents or methodological patents or things like that, and then with regard to the beta cell issue, I have been insulin-dependent diabetic since I was in my teens. So I've got 40-some-odd years of injecting insulin to stay alive, and this is just a fascinating thing. I'm a textbook example. My daughter, unfortunately, at the same 15 years of age, is another textbook example. And these, you know, seeing the dysbiosis problems with all of the various organs in this digestive arena and the lack of your body to utilize those, you know, those sugars that are floating in your bloodstream is just fabulous. So praise to you guys for leaping off in this direction. But my question really is about moving from insight to innovation and thinking about patents and technological or methodological, or what do you envision in those realms? I'm thinking there ought to be some monetization value for U of O.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, thank you very much for your questions and especially for your comments. I think it's clear that many people are impacted by the research that's done here, and we can talk more about that if you would like. In terms of the actual innovation, there's a couple of things that I would like to highlight. One is that, yes, obviously we encourage faculty to get patents, and we evaluate our portfolio. The idea here would be to greatly accelerate that process by actually building an intellectual infrastructure that will be housed in these new buildings that will help support that activity. Right now, the university has to pick and choose a little bit as to how they do that, whereas we imagine moving forward, this is going to be a much more aggressive option. Those patents are do help generate licensing fees that are then monetized back to the University of Oregon. I'd be happy to talk to you about how that works. But it is a good thing that can help support the university down the line. The other component of this that I think is almost completely unique at a national scale is that we are planning on having in what we're calling the innovation space, which will be spaces within these buildings that can be rented by startups, essentially. And as part of the effort, when we got this spinning up, myself and a number of faculty have gone all over the country to look to see what the best practices are. And one of the exciting models that's just emerged is we tend to think, oh, if you want to rent a space, you'll have an industrial park and you'll get a floor of a building or something like that. A graduate student can start up their own company, or a postdoc, or what they really need is maybe just a couple of feet of lab bench space and then access to all the high-tech equipment that's around there. And so our model is to have very flexible scales of space that are rentable essentially by the foot of research space, as what my colleague Jim Hutchinson's like to call the white belt level, where you're just figuring out how you're going to get going. So that creates lowers the barrier between getting from the discovery and the patent to actually then thinking about how you're going to move that out. There's a lot of patents that are generated and then they just sit around. And the same way that most of the results that we produce as scientists go into a paper and then they sit around, no one cares about them. So the best way to accelerate the impact is to actually create a path to moving them out more directly. With regard to the microbiome, we actually have an international reputation in this area. We have an NIH Centers of Excellence for Microbiome Research that's led by Dr. Gilliman. And so it is a fascinating new area of and so this is one example where just a protein that's produced by a microbe affects human function. So it is an area of discovery. And the question is, how could we accelerate that by doing large-scale, maybe robotic-driven assays and screens for those kinds of proteins and their effects on human tissue? So that's the kind of work that we would like to be able to build facilities to facilitate.
Other questions? From my perspective, I just want people to know, this is a bill we'll never see because it's not a bill. It's just Ways and Means. They're asking for $100 million There's going to be a lot of conversations about the resources that are available, and I felt that as a policy committee, it would be good for us to at least see that, because the other people who are going to talk about it are in Ways and Means. And as interest grows, you need to be able to talk to some of those other people on Ways and Means to say, is this pro for or whatever. We're talking about $1 billion total investment at some point, with you raising about $300 million. $500 million came already from.
Already raised $500 million, yes, and so so we're hoping to raise another $500 million,
yeah, including $100 million of that from the state
and beyond, quite frankly.
Yeah.
But that's the target. Yes.
And the other part you're talking about is that some of that money will go into endowments, so you can endow the science and the other people that are there, so you're not impacting state funds in the future.
Exactly. So that's the main ethos that we're committed to, is that we don't create any sort of investment lag on the rest. We totally recognize that this is a difficult year for the state. I'm not sure that that's ever not been true. But it's very difficult time for our students and everyone. And so there's no additional load on general funds that the state and no additional load on tuition dollars. This will all be self-funded as a separate activity. Again, and that's, as far as we know, that's unique in on a national scale. So in some ways, it's a uniquely Oregon solution to some Oregon issues that we've had. So so it's a great opportunity for partnership at the outset to make sure that we get launched so that we can reach the heights. And I will also say this, I've traveled around the country. The eyes of the country are on Oregon right now. This is the largest gift ever to a public flagship university. It's at a scale that exceeds almost all private gifts to private universities. So this is really a reputational thing for the entire state. It's a great opportunity for us to really take a step up in the research sphere. And, you know, we have some pretty stiff competitive neighbors to the south and the north of us, but I think that the future is quite bright for Oregon just because of the economies of living in those areas for economic development, and we're going to build the infrastructure to help support that.
And the reason that they put a biologist in charge is he was the only real scientist that covers the whole gamut and looks at the whole thing, as opposed to the chemists and the physicists and all these other people that break everything down into unusable parts, and you have to put them back together as a biologist.
Chairman Roblin, you may know that I am not a politician. However, I do know enough not to answer that question.
To say the man. I was a biology major for a long time, so I understand the differences between all of them, and it's really nice to have a place where everybody's going to work together to try to figure out how it does, because what we found is taking them all apart doesn't give us the answers we want. It's the combinations that come back together to make new things, and what this institution is going to do, which actually makes the new discoveries. And you never know who it is you need to talk to find that next discovery. And I really like the little blurb, because they were talking over a cup of coffee. I think it is that kind of thing that engenders new thoughts, new ideas, and the more you can have a diversity of people there talking to each other, the greater chance of having things happen. Great to hear your story about that. I'm wondering if it would also help type 2 diabetics, having been one of those. there's a lot of us that have pancreas problems, so it would be nice to see the kind of stuff. And the other day I heard from a young woman who is also a researcher at Oregon, who was looking at how do we use rust. I thought that was really intriguing. So basically, she's looking at nanoparticles of oxidized iron oxide, which they can attach medicines to and then direct them wherever you want them to the tumor, and then they release the medicine that's there. They can put higher dosages right on cancer cells than they can where we do it today. And, in fact, she said you could also heat up those iron oxide molecules, and cancer cells don't like heat, so you can do some things more directly. The less intrusive and the more we get people who are really thinking about these things in creative ways, the greater chance we have of making a deal. But I absolutely agree with you on figuring out how to monetize that for the schools in the future as well. Yes, Senator.
Yeah. Well, just in terms of this conversation, it's a great conversation. Thank you for coming. And, you know, in the nanotechnology biology sphere, the world is exploding. when I first became diabetic as a teenager, it was equine insulin from the slaughterhouse.
That's right.
You know, and sometimes pork, sometimes equine. Today, it's grown, you know, essentially in the petri dish, and it's human insulin, oddly enough, spliced into E. coli bacteria, but nevertheless, it works. It's like, yeah, this is great.
If I may respond, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but yes, in material science, actually in nanotechnology, you may know about the ONAMI efforts that the state has supported in the past, and the University of Oregon is one of the centers of that. And so our material sciences chemists are all part of this thinking forward. Biomaterial interfaces are going to be very important. The conversations that we're having with OHSU are focused on, they're very interested. As a matter of fact, their major focus is on early cancer detection. We have chemists that are very good at synthesizing new compounds that can be used as tracers and markers. And so we really think that there's an opportunity for these two campuses to get together around some of these issues. OHSU is a wonderful medical school. They're not part of a university anymore. They used to be part of the University of Oregon. So they don't have a chemistry department. They don't have a math department. They don't have a computer science department. So there's linkages across these areas that we want to build. And the same is true for OSU. They have talent and skills in their College of Engineering that we don't have, and it's going to take a team effort. I think this regional solution is where these other schools are looking in the Bay Area. It's not just Berkeley, which is a great institution. It's Berkeley is now coupling with Stanford and UC San Francisco, and Harvard and MIT are great in Boston, but they don't think they're good enough. They're actually creating research institutes that span those things. And I think the future for Oregon is to get this infrastructure built. The University of Oregon, we can elevate OHSU, OSU, and then to think the next generation in the next decade is going to be what is the regional approach. And so really getting this started on a strong way so that we have, I like to think of it as, you know, playing volleyball in the sand. You got to jump off that thing. The stronger you have there, then we're going to be able to jump to the next thing, which I think is going to be really talking about how the industry in the state, the universities, the state together can get together to move us to the next level. And we are so lucky to be able to even be having that conversation now because of the way that we're getting this started. So it's really an exciting future.
Any other questions for any of our people? Thank you very much for coming and sharing with us. And I hope as a committee we understand that, you know, your influence in talking to people as we look at these different, it's going to be tough making decisions with regard to how we allocate the resources we have at the state. So I hope this information can be helpful for all of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We appreciate you.
And thanks for coming on May 4th. Yes.
I could not be happier.
So with that, we will close our public informational meeting on the University of Oregon Science Campus. Is there any other conversations or whatever that we want to have? Thank you very much. We're going to close our Senate Education Committee here today on May the 4th be with you.
Did he say May the 4th be with you? May the 4th be with you? Did he say